Have you tried changing your health year on year, resolving that this year things are going to be different, but nothing seems to change? Oftentimes, when things are not changing, we are following many wellness myths and not looking at the full picture, including our nutrition, recovery, stress management, leaving out mind-body connection. I want to introduce you to Wellness Redefined, a new podcast from Rufilion Media that's here to dispel all your myths about wellness and fitness while sharing stories of how we've redefined what it means to be healthy. On each episode, we'll be talking to experts from all walks of life who will share their own unique wellness journey and offer their perspective. I am your host, Tamika Rochester, founder and CEO of Harlem Cycle, a premier wellness space in New York City with a focus on indoor cycling. I've been an advocate for wellness since as early as I can remember. So if this sounds like something that could help change your life, go ahead and pause the show you're listening to and subscribe to Wellness Redefined on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, folks. Welcome to Inclusive Collective, where we share stories and learnings of inclusive people, organizations, and innovation. I'm your co-host, Nadia Butt, an organizational development and belonging strategist, and I'm joined with my very good friend, Rob Hadley, a people and culture strategist specializing in DE&I and people analytics. Hello, Rob.
Hey, Nadia. How are we doing today?
Doing great. It's such a beautiful day today.
It is a beautiful day. Well, I guess we're in different places, so it's a beautiful day here as well.
Glad to hear that.
Nadia, so we had Dr. Giuliana Simonetti last week, who I have somewhat of a relationship with, a 20-year relationship with. She's my partner, spouse, wife. What do you want to say?
Best friend.
Best friend. She's my best friend
too now.
And that's what I wanted to share with you. How many people over the last week do you think have told me that I married up in life, that they so much more enjoy hearing her than hearing me?
I know at least one person that said it. probably
including my co-host. Yeah.
Including your co-host. I would say maybe 7 people said it to you.
7. I think it's over 10. Yeah.
So no way.
Really? Yeah. Yeah. People really enjoy it.
Did you
really
tell Giuliana this?
Yeah, I did. I said, I said it's hard to to hear. I probably wouldn't have brought her on if I knew I was going to hear all week about how much more awesome she is than
That's
I am. So,
Rob, you're
but,
just
but you know
good.
What? It says a lot
she's
about
just
me,
so
too.
So fun.
It says a lot about me, too, right? That
what
she sees something in me.
Yes, this is true. She saw something.
She sees my potential.
She sees your potential. After all these years. No, you both are such a lovely couple, and I love you both. And I was just so excited to have her on because she just has so much knowledge in medicine and obesity, and just it was great. So, you know what? I feel like you both married appropriately. Nobody married
thanks.
Up here.
Oh, thanks. Not what you said this week, but yes, thank you.
Oh, that's hilarious. Should we get to the deets?
Let's do the deets. So this, again, I don't always want to talk about it, but I feel like we have to talk about our friend, Mr. Elon Musk.
He's in every news article. Like, I literally was just going through, like, New York Times and Washington Post. It's like, Twitter, Elon Musk, Twitter, Elon Musk. And I'm like, I'm so over him.
Yeah. So I went from a little bit of a different angle, right? So there's something that I found particularly egregious that I haven't seen a lot of. I've seen, a little bit on LinkedIn. And that was the fact that one of the first things he did was disband the ERGs, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just thought that was just a particularly egregious thing, right? If you think about that, so employee resource groups, for those that don't know, or affinity groups, these are things that companies form and use for many reasons. ERGs, they're often a safe place for employees of minoritized or marginalized backgrounds within a greater company. They're incredibly helpful for creating mentorship opportunities. They are often the source of product innovation, et cetera, right? You and I, Nadia, have talked about, we've had debates about the efficacy of ERGs, and some companies have a really good reasons to move away from them, and that's certainly in flux. And if you did a long review of the ERG and you said, hey, this isn't working, for whatever reason, we want to go in a different direction for this employee population, that's one thing. That's not what happened here. This was without actually... No, this was without actually meeting with them or being aware of what they do, what they bring to the organization, just disbanding them. And so that just sends a really stark message that I don't give a shit about these issues or these employees. And I just think that it's just particularly
racist.
I feel like it's almost threatening, right? In some ways, yeah. Right? How do you feel about it? How would you feel about it if someone walked in and just said, we're just getting rid of these?
You know, we have clients, you and I, who've asked, like, do, you know, who kind of jump to a solution, like, and say, let's, we have to create an ERG group. We have to create a business affinity, like an employee affinity group. And my first question is always like, well, why? What are you trying to solve for? Are you trying to solve for retention? Are you trying to solve for creating mentorship, development opportunities? Do you want to build awareness? And oftentimes, I think that's what they're built for. So I hope they're built for a reason. Now, totally agree with you that there are organizations right now moving away from them because they aren't maybe doing some sort of audit. Like you're not, they're not as effective as you had hoped for them. But he, like you said, is coming in and kind of not understanding. He's not seeking to learn or understand participation, events, kind of what are the benefits, what are maybe not the benefits of having these ERGs. He is using his power and privilege as a white, you know, male to show dominance that he doesn't think that they're valuable. And to me, that's the basis of white supremacy. So I said it. And he's advocating for that. He also dismissed so many other groups, like the employees that were working on human rights within the organizations and some of the other entities within the organization. So like he just doesn't value what diversity, equity, inclusion brings to an organization. That's maybe an assumption. I've never spoke to him.
I think but it's I'm pretty sure
it's on point.
Yeah, yeah. One of the other things he did was this past week was he sent an email to all employees in the middle of the night. Also not press practice, just on its face, sending emails in the middle of the night to all your employees, saying that everyone had to commit to being hardcore or be fired, right? And so, first of all, like there's an over the top bro-ness of that language, for right? Hardcore. Does that kind of language inspire you, Nadia? Are you into that? So, you know, people will work 90 hours a week for a vision, right? They will work in terrible conditions. They will work with desks that are literally doors ripped off the wall and onto sawhorses. And they will, you know, they will use not effective resources and material if there's a vision that they're supporting.
Aligned to, sure.
And Mr. Musk hasn't laid out any sort of vision. He's laid out the vision of being hardcore. And that's people really aren't really into that these days. So, and predictably, lots of employees left. 1,000 or well over 1,000 at this point, leaving Twitter on the brink of collapse. So, you know, we'll keep watching this. Anything else from Twitter that you want to talk about?
No.
Ever again? No? Okay.
Good. I mean, we stopped using it as a as a social media platform. And I know companies are no longer advertising, have kind of exited. Many of my friends stopped using it who were like avid Twitter. Like these are folks that were like using it for their news and using it for updates and use no other social platforms except for Twitter and have left. So good riddance. And I do hope those employees that are seeking really talented folks that work at Twitter, I know a few. So those folks that are impacted, please feel free to connect with us if we can help in any way.
Awesome. What's next?
So I read this the other day, really excited because I don't know if you know this about me, Rob, but I played tennis in high school. We were state champs for 4 years in a row.
Awesome.
You know this?
I did not know that.
Okay. Well, I played doubles.
You still play tennis?
Doubles. That's hard to answer that question. I think if I played a couple years ago, I think
pick up
a racket comes back, but I don't take the time to play. So anyways, Wimbledon will allow women to wear colored undershorts in nod to period concerns. So according to NPR's article in NPR and BBC coverage, Wimbledon's famously strict rules that required all white clothing for their players now is making an exception. So female players can wear dark colored undershorts beneath their skirts or shorts or skorts, as I've heard. The rules about white clothing initially began as a measure to prevent sweat stains from showing up on colored clothing. And now in the rule book, an asterisk has been added to the rules that permits female players to wear solid mid-dark colored undershorts, provided that they are no longer than their shorts or skirt. This change comes after some current and former players kind of addressed it and shared their distress around having to wear all white when they're having when they're on their menstrual cycles and periods. Organizers of Wimbledon said that the new rule follows discussion with Women's Tennis Association, the WTA, clothing manufacturers, and medical teams, which is great. So really cool, really excited that we've made these exceptions.
Really progressive.
I still think they're a little antiquated.
Really progressive.
In some manner. Really progressive.
136 years in, right? 136 years in.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if you remember, but like the tennis community in general gave Serena Williams like a really hard time when she wore, and even back in the day, like Andre Agassi, like people wore really vibrant colors instead of just all white, and people gave these players like a hard time. And to me, it's like, what's the harm? Like, let these players. I mean, I understand there's like an etiquette, but it's like, come on. Like,
yeah,
to me,
that was a question I had. Are men being allowed? I don't know if you saw it in here. Should men be allowed to do the same? Not so much for false equivalent equity, but you know, every time a woman is wearing dark undershorts.
Yeah. They'll know when
then
she has
a now
period.
Then are we supposed to, is that drawing more attention to it? And I think that would have the issue of being distracting for them as well. So if men were allowed to also wear dark undershorts, then they could support this effort in solidarity as an ally and as well. So
agree. So small steps towards equity and fairness. And I still think they have a long way to go. So Wimbledon, WTA. Tennis in general, because there's other, you know, we got the U.S. Open, we got other kind of places where people play tennis. I really like taking a hard look at like what are some of these antiquated rules and fairness around them.
Love it.
All right, folks. Thank you, Rob, for those deets. We will be right back after a few messages with our guest, Mary Fernandez.
Welcome back. We're joined today by disability inclusion consultant Mary Fernandez. Colombian-born and New Jersey-raised, Mary first ventured to the South to attend Emory University, where she majored in psychology and music. After graduating, Mary worked at a civil rights litigation law firm as a paralegal focusing on disability rights. Mary then held a variety of positions in the field of disability advocacy before starting her own consulting practice focused on web accessibility and inclusion. Mary received her MBA from Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Mary is currently the lead disability inclusion consultant on Cisco's DEI team. Mary identifies as disabled, brown, and she uses she, her pronouns. She approaches the work from always centering communities and constantly listening and learning from the experiences of others. In her free time, Mary enjoys reading, romance novels and thrillers. Those are my favorites as well. Cooking, singing, and learning to play poker. Apparently, she said it's easier than it looks. Awesome. Mary Fernandez, welcome to Inclusive Collective. So good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Mary, so good to have you on. Thank you for joining us. So as a disability and inclusion consultant that's focused on equity and accessibility, what do you feel are the greatest barriers and then failings in corporations that are concerning accessibility?
Well, that's all we only have.
That's a really
20
big question.
Are there any?
No, we're good. That's, you know, I have worked myself out of a job. We are perfect now. I will go become a professional chef. You know, when you talk to the disabled community in general, I think that the one thing we agree on is that it's the attitudes around disability that really impact our quality of life, our experiences in the world. Because when we think about disability, first of all, people feel great discomfort. They don't know what language to use. They don't know what to say. And even when you think about children asking about disability, so oftentimes when I walk down the street with my white cane, kids are like, "Mommy, what's that for?" It happened the other day. It was me and my friends. We were walking down and she goes, "It's to tell them where they are." And my friend stops like, "Well, no, it doesn't talk. It doesn't tell us where we are. It's a tool to help us navigate, to figure out what's in front of us and what's around us through tactile and sound, right?" That's just one example of, like, you know, kids' curiosity. And then we either shush them or give them bad information instead of just saying, I don't know, what are you going to ask them? And then that curiosity becomes shameful later on. And what's really interesting about disability is that it's the one common shared experience that we will have from a perspective of being a minority at some point. At some point, you will have a disability, whether that's temporary or permanent, which is why I use the term non-disabled, because it's not ability that we're going to share in common. It's disability, whether you sprain an ankle, which I did the other day, or break an elbow, or whatever the case may be, at some point we will all be disabled. And so it's the attitudes around fear, around shame, and then ableism, right? Which is this notion that one kind of mind, one kind of body is superior than others, and the norm mm-hmm. that we establish is non-disabled. And then because everybody with a mind and a body can experience ableism, it's another common experience, but we don't often recognize it. And so the fact that we don't know how to unpack ableism, and that oftentimes the people talking about disability, if at all, at DEI are non-disabled, presents a myriad of challenges, because then you start getting, if there is a strategy, if there is a conversation at all, which is its own problem, we don't have enough representation. Disability is often forgotten in DEI. Mm-hmm. But if you do have a point of view coming from non-disabled people, mm-hmm. it's being led by non-disabled people. It's not centering communities. It's really led from this point of view. It's almost making non-disabled people feel better about themselves, because disabled people are a charity case in essence. And that's a reflection of ableism. Then you start getting harmful initiatives that aren't actually centering disabled folks. And so mm-hmm. to me, that's really the biggest barrier. If we can start even learning how to talk about disability in a way that is constructive, that is helpful, if we can start recognizing our own ableism, because we all have it, then we will be taking a step in the right direction around, okay, we at least understand the issue. We understand the core barriers, then we can start dismantling them. Right now, I don't think that from that perspective, we've even have a real true understanding. And then accessibility, to me, disability, inclusion, and accessibility are interlocked, but are not the same. Because accessibility really refers to how people are able to navigate, operate, interact in the world, whether that's physical, right, through like ramps and signage and being able to reach things at whatever height you might be approaching the world from. That's like the infrastructure. Same goes for digital accessibility. Am I able to navigate, operate, interact, and use any tool, technology, software, platform in the way that it was intended to without barrier, because I'm using assistive technology? So that's the infrastructure. That's, to me, that's the bar. That's the lowest common denominator, and we're not there.
Mary, just a follow-up on that. And so yeah. Let's say I run an organization. I feel like I've taken DEI seriously, but I'm listening to this conversation. I'm like, well, I haven't done a great job on the accessibility piece of DEI, right? It hasn't been mm-hmm. necessarily a primary focus. And if step one is learn to have constructive conversations around disability, what's the starting point there? What's the tactical, how do I start down that path?
So for accessibility or disability or both?
For either disability and then accessibility.
So on accessibility, that's almost easier, because like I said, yep. this accessibility is an infrastructure piece. And so when you start thinking about from the tech industry, what we've seen of companies that are leading in accessibility, they created an accessibility office, right? And the key for accessibility is that you have to have governance and ownership and make it a priority. So when Apple started incorporating accessibility into all their products, they made it a priority that we want our products to be out of the box accessible for everybody and in as many ways as possible. Whereas back in the day, Like in 2014, mm-hmm. if you were blind and you bought a phone, you'd have to buy additional software for that phone. And then you would have to keep buying updates for that phone in order to be usable. Mm. And it wasn't compatible with all the phones. And so when Apple came around and did that accessibility and they were leading that, it was the first company to do it. It disrupted the market and it set a standard and a benchmark for this is important. And now we see it in most devices that there is mm-hmm. some kind of accessibility technology built in. That is new. I was not able to buy a TV out of the box that I would be able to use even 10 years ago. So that's massive. So from an accessibility perspective, we still have a long way to go. And the first thing that a company really needs to do is A, make a commitment. We're going to do this. And then B, prioritize it. C, create governance and ownership. And then D, figure out how disruptive you want to be. Because it's not necessarily always having to spend more money, but you have to create an engine, right, that puts out accessible products. And that means that it's a transformational motion. It's not a one and done motion.
Sure.
So you're transforming the way that you do business and you have to reallocate resources in order to kickstart that. And then you hopefully get to that maturity model that now you're maintaining rather than starting from the beginning. So that's that piece from the accessibility perspective, from the disability inclusion, which is deeply interlocked, right? So going back to that infrastructure, if I create a house where everybody can enter and navigate, but then I don't train people to be able to connect across different, the people that are in there are going to have separate experiences. And so then we get into, at the very basic level, what is your accommodations process at your corporation? Do you have a centralized budget for accommodations? And the reasons that's really important is because you don't want different departments having different notions of how much they shouldn't and shouldn't spend on mm-hmm. disabled folks.
Right.
It shouldn't really, because when we leave it to that, right, all of a sudden you're giving the power to non-marginalized folks to decide what I do and do not need. You give them the power to believe me or not on what I do and do not need. And then you're also setting the standard of every person with disability works differently. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to need different accommodations. I always say, like, in my house, lighting is an accommodation I provide to sighted people. I don't need the light.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I love that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I am making that accommodation for y'all. Right. And in our environments, we create the environments that work best when you're non-disabled and nobody comes into your house like, oh, that lighting's wrong. I don't like that. You know what I mean? And so it's the same. We have to believe people and their experiences. And at the very least, you need to figure out how do you do accommodations? Because that informs a lot about how you're thinking about disability. And the second P is representation. You have to have disabled people in the conversation. And you have to hire them and you have to promote them and create a path to leadership and decision making.
So, Mary, what does that look like? You know, when we think about folks that we recruit this talent, we hire them. What are you seeing now what are you observing right now where managers and companies are seeking and asking, how do we make accommodations? Like, what does that conversation look like? And then what in the last maybe 5 or 6 years have you observed where there are actual, truly, like, what are the actual accommodations what are some examples of accommodations that are being made right now?
Let me start with the second one. So accommodations are so all over the place in corporations because everybody does it so differently. Like, it's all over the place. That I don't know that there is a trend. What there is, though, is there is a bigger trend and a bigger conversation around disability in general.
Sure.
So you have companies like the Valuable 500. You have Disability In. You've had different initiatives to really think around disability. And I think that the conversation has now entered the universe where previously there wasn't even the conversation around disability at all.
Absolutely.
And that has come from accessibility. So I always say you want to build accessibly because then you lessen the need for some, not all, accommodations. So that is to say, if I have a phone that I use, right, because we all use our phones with our work now, like my calendar, my email, everything works on my phone. Well, if I have a phone that hadn't had accessible software to begin with, then I need a separate accommodation for that. Sure. Then I need to figure out, how do I work? So I think the real focus is, how do we build accessibly? How do we build with that notion that we're going to build for the margins, knowing that we're going to include more people in the middle? Mm-hmm. And then how do you accommodate? Then that comes down to really understanding your privilege and understanding where you hold things that privileges in a way that you don't even think about
right,
what the experience is for others. And then believe people. If somebody tells you I need a Braille display, you're like, well, I met a blind person who didn't read Braille, so you don't need that. Like, no.
Mm-hmm.
So I think really believing people is important. And you had the first question. I can't remember what it was now.
Thank you for answering that. The first question was related to what are you observing right now where managers are having these, how are they having these types of conversations mm-hmm. to seek accommodation? Because what I've found in my career working with, middle managers and leaders is that sometimes they don't want to even ask because they're so afraid to break the law or offend someone. And so instead it's like avoidance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm wondering from your perspective, how would a manager go about asking or seeking kind of that conversation to understand more around someone who's living with disabilities?
There are systems that we can put in place to help facilitate that, right? And hopefully, I think all companies are doing this now, but in every step of the process of hiring somebody and onboarding them, making sure that you're asking if you need accommodations, do this. And then having an actual process, because what we find sometimes is that people will say, yes, I need this accommodation. And then there's no systemic process in place. And so that needs to be part of it. The second part as a manager would be, one, really educating yourself and finding resources to understand what the disabled experience is, and also understand that disability is such a huge umbrella that not everybody is the same and not everybody is going to experience marginalization and oppression at the same level. So if you have an invisible disability.
And there's invisible and visible disabilities, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
If you have an invisible disability, your experience is very different and you're going to have different struggles than if you have a visible disability. So for me, one of the biggest things is figuring out how do we provide awareness. And that's where I really kind of come down on this representation piece from DEI perspectives of having that as part of your DEI strategy, as part of your DEI training. Disability has to be in it. And that's where it has to live, that training, because you also don't want to burden marginalized folks with having to do all the education. So you don't want to go to your one disabled person in your team that you know has a disability. Be like, tell me
how you feel. Yeah. What's your experience? And that, right. And then we design the accommodations based off that one person when that's just maybe one or two disabilities that person's living with. And so,
exactly.
So, love that.
So yeah, that self-awareness and understanding for yourself what it may be like, and then creating opportunities for everyone to share, or creating opportunities for people to share their needs. So one very simple trick I tell people is, when you're creating an event, always have a checkbox that says, if you need accommodations, check here, and somebody will be in touch with you to discuss what that looks like, right? So for virtual meetings, maybe somebody needs ASL, but if they don't have a place to put that in, then they might not get that accommodation. Mm-hmm. So that's very simple. How do you create
such
opportunities
for
people to share?
Hey, Mary, just want to continue to follow up on that. So a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how workforce participation for people with disabilities is at an all-time high right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's not high. It's at an all-time high.
Yes.
Due to, one, there's a widespread labor shortage, and then also mm-hmm. the rise of remote work, right? And so, but we're starting to see layoffs. especially in your area of tech that you focus on. So, and people really want their people back at the office for some reason in a lot of companies. Mm-hmm. And so, can you just talk about what remote work has meant to people with disabilities, and what are your things you consult about in terms of companies wanting to bring people back to the office? How do you do that in a way that is inclusive?
So I'll start with the first one. What does remote work offer for people with disabilities? And it's actually been a huge game changer. One of the big things, actually, is that a lot of times when you start through that interview process and such, it's actually a big debate. And most of us that have visible disabilities, whether you disclose or not. Because as soon as you disclose, you're going to start facing discrimination. Like, that's just a given. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, people are going to make all kinds of assumptions. So me showing up on video for an interview is very different than me walking in with my white cane into an office where all of a sudden it's like, it's amazing. It's like a switch goes off in people's head and they assume all of a sudden I can't do all of these things. So that piece has been huge because it gives people a little bit of an option that not always of disclosing or not. And at what point in the process they want to disclose. I don't know that there's data around that yet, but I would love for some people to research around what, like, you know, compare and contrast, what hiring looks like, depending whether you disclose or not, depending whether you did your process virtually or not. So that's one piece. The other piece is just straight up transportation. Do you know how difficult it is to navigate the world, like, in a wheelchair?
Yeah.
At 30 years after that ADA was passed, we still do not have accessible infrastructures. We just don't. So getting to and from an office is a logistical project that people with mobility disabilities, who are blind or low vision, like any disability, it's a project. It's just a straight up project. And it takes up a lot of energy and it takes up a lot of mental resilience. It takes a lot. And so that piece of just literally not having to commute and deal with that has been huge. And it removes a lot of barriers of literally how do you get to and from the office and how long it takes you. And then there's the third piece, which is around accommodations. We create our homes to be accessible to us. And we choose places that are accessible to us. So you don't have to go into an office and recreate what you have at home in order to be the most productive that you can be. So I think those are three of the big things that come top of mind to me. And, you know, I don't speak for all disabled people. So anyone with a disability listening, like, well, that's not me. Like, I understand that. But I think, like, trend-wise, those might be some of the big things that affect that. And then I think if you want to continue being inclusive, you have to think about hybrid work. And then also making sure that people that are working virtually and remotely aren't being disadvantaged by that, right? We have to make sure that we are assessing people's performance and talent in a way that is fair across whether you're in an office or not, that you have the same visibility and the same opportunities for visibility in leadership. Whether you're working from home or not. Like, that's really, really important.
Right.
Sure. Mary, it's interesting because I have a few clients that are in the industries of, say, construction, energy, environment. And oftentimes with many of these clients, I'll look at their job descriptions and how inclusive they are. And it's interesting because we did a we kind of did like an audit for this one client who, like, 80% of the job descriptions were like, you have to be able to carry like 70 pounds or more.
Yep.
And like when we spoke to the recruitment team and the, you know, the hiring manager was like, is this really true? Like, does the employee actually have to be able to carry 70 pounds or more? And they were like, no. And so I was like, well, why is it on here?
Right.
And, you know, because in my mind, what I find, especially when you're sourcing or you're trying to recruit people, like if I read a job description and it says like you have to be able to carry 70 pounds. I'd be like, can't do. The jobs might sound interesting to me, but if I can't carry that, then I'm going to be like, forget it, I'm not even going to bother applying. And not that every person that's a candidate is doing that, but I'm just curious, like, have you run into that? I know you're in the tech world, and maybe there's not a whole lot of 70 pounds or more to carry, but I'm so curious because I think of like Amazon kind of calls themselves, say, like a tech company or an innovative company. But when you're working in the warehouse, for example, maybe you do have to be able to carry a certain number of pounds. So I'm just curious if you're seeing inclusive language and job descriptions evolve.
I think it is evolving. I think of a lot of like the automated tools that exist now for kind of running your descriptions through them to see how inclusive they are. But a lot of them are really focusing on gender and race. And again, that's where disability is missing from this equation overall. And it's interesting because it's the one intersection, right, where anybody of any identity can experience disability. So to me, it almost, and I'm biased because I'm disabled, but to me, it's almost like the common denominator of when we think about inclusion, what does that look like for disability? And we can branch out into how it looks like for all identities that may experience disability. I think it is evolving a little bit. I think that we're focusing on two main identities. And then I also know historically, and it still happens, there are industries and there are jobs and there are agencies and companies that specifically put in, you have to be able to carry X number of pounds and you have to have a driver's license for any job. It doesn't matter what it is, specifically to screen out disabled people. Like this is an actual thing that we know has happened historically and continues to happen in certain areas. And some of it is intentional and some of it is unintentional, but it has the same effect. You know, I'm not sure why I have to be able to drive to do filing. I'm not sure.
No,
I can take an Uber. I can take a horse. You know, if there's somewhere to park my horse, I can take a horse.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like if you can get into the office some kind of way, why does it matter how you get there?
Right.
Totally agree. And I'm definitely going to start looking for a horse. That's a great idea.
And then we need to create a horse parking spaces. Yeah.
Yes.
Great. Horse hitching posts. Yeah.
Yes.
Why no hitching posts? Mary, we're having so much fun with you today. I do want to ask, are there any resources that you recommend for people that want to get a little bit smarter on the topics of disability, be able to have inclusive conversations around disability, and then also accessibility as well?
Yeah. Great documentary that everybody needs to watch who wants to learn about disability, at least in the American context, is Crip Camp on Netflix.
Okay.
And it details the disability civil rights movement leading to the ADA. In the Crip Camp website, there are so many amazing resources around ableism, learning how to speak about it, all of those things. There's an entire curriculum. It is wonderful. And then the other piece I would say, as far as accessibility, if you're a content creator of any sort using like Microsoft tools, the Microsoft Accessibility website has very detailed tutorials of how to make things accessible. You know, and then you could kind of go down the rabbit hole depending what it is that you want to focus on from an accessibility perspective, because that gets that it's a huge world out there. And then the third piece I would say is always be reading and looking for things that are written by disabled people, content that is done by disabled people, in anything that you absorb, because what I often find is that we rely on sources that are written by non-disabled people, and then we get into a little bit of trouble because we think we learned something, and then we come to find out, like, you know, we're using interesting language that disabled people aren't necessarily using for themselves. And the last piece I would say is always when you're having conversations, pay attention to how people refer to themselves. I identify as disabled. Not everybody with a disability identifies as disabled. I use identity first language. I say that I'm a disabled person, not a person with a disability, because it impacts the way that I am able to move through the world and the way that I experience the world. But it is really up to the individual to decide where they are in their journey and how they want to talk about themselves. So I think paying attention and really centering them in your one-on-one interactions is really important.
I love that. Mary Fernandez, thank you so much for joining the Inclusive Collective today. We hope you can come back and join us again soon.
Thank you all for having me.
Thank you.
Come back and talk to us again.
Okay. Well, I have a lot of thoughts. So yeah.
Yeah, we have a lot. I have a lot more questions. So yeah, come back and talk to us again.
I always say, like, I have a lot of opinions, and I found a profession that allows me and pays me to give.
Yeah,
so I'm here for.
So great. That's awesome. I love it.
Thanks,
that.
Everybody. Thank
Excellent.
You.
Excellent. Well, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Inclusive Collective. Back from our conversation with Mary Fernandez. Nadia, your thoughts on meeting Mary and learning a little bit about her perspective as a disabled person.
She was great. I feel like I say that about every guest, but she really, I feel like I was starting to reflect on my own misunderstanding or misconception. I love that she pointed out some tactical tips that a manager can leverage and use. I think those are always really helpful. And then I appreciated her calling, reminding us that not every person has the same disability and that not every solution is going to solve for every individual, right? So like it's almost like it's customized. We have to ask the questions, seek accommodations for these people and really be cognizant of that. So I thought that was really great. What were your takeaways?
Similarly, humbling in terms of just thinking about my own the work that I do and how do you bring more perspectives into the conversation, right? We do the best that we can as people that don't have any
people who are not living with
disabilities. And so how do we bring more voices in the conversation, even if we're doing design work and designing for equity? It's just a great idea to have someone that has lived experience in building out people processes as well. So really cool. I really hope to have her back and continue that conversation as well.
Absolutely.
It is the time. It is that time. We did the coin flip. Awesome. All right. Lead us off. Rave it.
All right. Rave. So I don't know if you are a fan of PBS. I am, but I'm a huge fan of, are you?
Of course. Of course.
Okay. Well, there's NewsHour. My dad has forever been watching NewsHour, 6 p.m. Judy Woodruff this past week announced that she's moving on to another project. And so she's not going to be the main anchor. And so replacing her is going to be Amna Nawaz and Jeffrey Bennett, both named to take her over as co-anchors. They're both fantastic journalists. I've been following Amna for a while. Love her. Excited. Both people are people of color. Amna is a Pakistani American Muslim. So I'm personally very excited for that.
Wow.
She just represents so much to me and for me. And so it's really cool seeing these journalists become co-anchors on a really, what I like to say is tries to be the most fairest and honest and trying, you know, truthful journalist and reporting in the news industry.
Yeah. No, it's so boring. They just have like no graphics and they just talk
so
for
truthful.
Like, sometimes a news story can go on for like 8 or 9 minutes and you're like,
so true.
Don't need all that. Right. Like
yeah.
People that are tuned in for Fox News are like, what is this? Just like 8 minutes of facts, one right after the other. So boring. Just kidding. No, that's awesome. I love that one. I'm going to rant and then we come back.
Yes.
So we'll end on a positive note. No, I think this is a positive note as well. In honor of Native American Heritage Month, a House committee this week weighed a proposal to seat a delegate from the Cherokee Nation in Congress as a non-voting delegate. Seating the delegate would uphold a 200-year-old agreement. So I had the privilege this past week to attend an event where with representatives from Utah, sovereign tribal nations.
Okay.
And there was a lot of history involved. They went through a lot of that history of broken treaties. It turns out there are quite a few broken treaties from the United States with the sovereign. So yeah, so I think that, you know, this turns out it's a nice time, right? Like we have Wimbledon turning, they're setting a new tradition, starting on a new tradition as well. So I think it's a great opportunity for the United States to start a new tradition of keeping its promises to sovereign tribal nations. There doesn't seem to be much to debate here. So Congress, that's, you know, all of them. It's time to seat Kim Teehee of the Cherokee Nation. So just get it done. That's my rant.
I love that. That's a great rant. Can I go to my second rave?
Yeah, let's do it. Big finish.
I saw Wakanda Forever last night. Rob, it was amazing.
Yeah? In a theater?
Yeah. I saw it in the theater. Me and my sister were like the only ones wearing masks. But saw it on the big screen. It was the first movie I've seen in like 4 or 5 years in the theater, which is also ridiculous. But it was just so good. And obviously, like, they honored Chadwick Boseman, which was so special. And what I really loved is that they centered Black women as like fierce and like power holding people that they are and they should be recognized for. And I was just like, yes, yes, yes. So if you have not seen it, go see it. It's so good.
All right. Well, I'm going to try to go see Wakanda Forever. Then it's suitable for 10-year-olds? Probably not, right? Probably PG-13.
No, I think so, actually. I'm not, you know, I don't know, but I
all right, we'll sneak him in. Whatever. Yeah, we'll sneak him in. All right, great time today, Nadia. Inclusive Collective is a production of Rifilion Media. We would love to hear from you. Send us your feedback at inclusivecollective@rifilion.com. You can also find us on LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, not Twitter. If you like what you heard, be sure to subscribe and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us for consulting, check out Nadia at nasconsultants.com and Rob at tacanoconsulting.com. Thanks again to our guest, Mary Fernandez. So much fun having her today. Look forward to having her again. We'll be back with you all next week. Thanks, Nadia.
Thank you. Be well. Oh